The views expressed in this episode of Squared Circle Gazette Radio aren't necessarily the true opinions of the individuals in the prosecution or the defense. But for the sake of debate, it's time to go to court.
No matter how it's booked, laid out, argued, lobbied, I'm not going to lobby for a finish on this one. I'm going to go over. Because I said so.
And welcome to the 30th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Limo Rock alongside Carl Jones.
Yo.
Chi-Chan Chase.
Oh!
Kieran O'Rourke.
Hello.
And back with us for the first time in a long time, and he is very much welcome back, Luke Edwards.
Got my gavel.
Yes, he does indeed, because we are here today for a very, very fun show. It is the third of the Squared Circle Gazette trials, and today we have Kevin Nash on trial. If you haven't listened to one of these shows before, you can go back to us if you subscribe to us on iTunes by looking for Squared Circle Gazette Radio. But now to explain the rules, we're going to hand it over to the Honourable Kieran O'Rourke.
The record's sake, the defence tried a lot harder with their round of applause than the prosecution.
Okay, as Liam said, we're here today for the trial of Kevin Nash. The charge against Big Kev, gross malpractice in his roles within the wrestling business, with malpractice defined as instances of negligence or incompetence on the part of a professional. Acting on the behalf of the prosecution today is Mr. Ji-Jon Chase and Carl Jones, while on the defence is Liam O'Rourke and the aforementioned, well, I suppose everyone's aforementioned, but Luke is as well.
I'm more aforementioned than many.
Okay, we're going to start off with the opening statement, starting with the prosecution before we pass it over to the defence. So, prosecution, if you'd like to get things underway and take your time, nice and steady, nice and clear, and you've got to convince me, sunshine. Oh, and I should say, for the record as well, I will not be using my vast knowledge of the professional wrestling industry in this court case for my judgment. It will be solely based on the evidence you provide for me today. So, give it your best, fellas, and on with the show.
Thank you. What can you really say about Kevin Nash? I mean, he's used for so many topical quizzes, isn't he? I mean, the obvious question you can ask is, like, what's the worst year in professional wrestling history? What's the worst year that WWF ever had? And pretty much everyone will unanimously say 1995. It is the benchmark for all that is shit. We ourselves on this podcast have used the year 1995 as a comparison for what's happening in the current product. And when you look at 1995, you have to look at the WWF champion at the time, and that was Big Daddy Cool himself, Diesel. A man who rose to power within that company in terms of getting his title push way too soon. And then once he got it, failed at every turn to draw money. Tonight, my colleague, Mr. Carl Jones, will guide you through this time period of Kevin Nash in the WWF, and also his behaviour backstage, and how detrimental it was, not just to this title reign, but also to the WWF as well. This plethora of garbage and shite, this absolute lava dump of a title reign, that is, as I said, the benchmark for all that is shit, will be explained beautifully by my colleague. Then, to make matters worse, not only did he worsen the WWF in 1995, but he then had the good grace to leave in 1996 and do the same to WCW. Carl Jones and myself will go through this time period of these early days of his involvement in WCW and his politicking, all the way through to when he was appointed booker, where we really get to the big old deuce. Okay? I will guide you through this time period at all the decisions he made and how he held down talent, stopped from veterans who were still popular and over at the time, buried them week in and week out. Throughout this court case, we will guide you through every single wrong moment that Kevin Nash had. And I'll just break it to you right now. That's every single moment Kevin Nash had. There's no redeeming qualities for Kevin Nash. Now, the defence will probably turn around and they'll tell you how a cool guy he is, that he's funny, and that he put Rey Mysterio over that one time, you remember that? But I'm going to tell you right now, he isn't cool. He's not Big Daddy Cool. He's just big shit sexy. And quite frankly, after tonight, you will believe he is guilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chase, and the prosecution for that opening statement. over to the defence right now. I believe we're going to Liam.
Yeah, thank you very much, Your Honour. I want to say that a lot of people, when this trial was devised, a lot of people said that this was going to be a tough one to defend. People have even heard the term shooting fish in a barrel used at one point to describe Kevin Nash on trial here at Squared Circle Gazette Radio. There were even rumours that my colleague, my co-counsel, Luke Edwards, faked a heart attack yesterday so they wouldn't have to appear here today.
For the record, the heart attack was real. I eat too much shit.
On this day, however, in this court, the finger poke of doom is pointing harshly and swiftly in the direction of the prosecution, who, much like Kevin Nash in 2002, don't have a leg to stand on here today. People like to persecute Kevin Nash, not because of what he's done throughout the course of his career, but because of what he is and what he represents. He's the tall guy that gets handpicked for greatness above smaller, perhaps more talented individuals. He's the guy that finds opportunity on his doorstep and gets to ride the fast track through this world. Because of this, they decide to focus on him and call him negligent, say he's guilty of malpractice, and overlook the obvious surrounding circumstances that made it impossible for Kevin Nash to succeed. We will illustrate here today that on these charges, Kevin Nash is an innocent man. And when this trial is over, Kevin Nash will be doing what he does best. Standing there with one hand in his pocket, pushing back his long, luscious hair with the other, a free man, continuing to moonwalk his way through life.
Oh my God. Thank you, Liam and Luke, for that sterling effort as an opening intro. And I must say, although this will not affect my judgment at the end of the court case, your opening jokes were much funnier than the prosecution's. Okay, we'll pass it back over to the prosecution now for your first of two case studies in the trial of Kevin Nash.
Thank you very much, Your Honour. We are here to try Kevin Nash on the charge of gross malpractice. And when it comes to his run in the World Wrestling Federation, particularly his run as champion, I feel this is a most just charge. Everybody in this courtroom, however much some may try to deny it, are well aware that Mr. Nash was incredibly poor in the ring. Some may say that he was given some poor opponents, and there may be an element of truth to that. But I will detail through his time in the WWF that there were multiple occasions where Kevin Nash displayed unprofessional behaviour inside the ring, which I believe contributed to such poor performances. For example, Mr. Nash is on record as being a heavy, heavy drug user during his time in the World Wrestling Federation. And if you will indulge me, I would like to just use a few quotes from Mr. Nash, taken from multiple interviews, most prominently a Wrestle Reunion interview from 2004 conducted with one Scott Hudson. On the subject of a European tour, we were smoking hash on the bus in Europe, breaking every rule. On the subject of somas, Sean and I were working together, we would take 10 each and then go to the ring, and the go-home cue was I'm kicking. Yet more somas quotes. The starting volley for us would be around 12. During this interview, Mr. Nash also decides to recant a story of when himself, Mr. Scott Hall, and Mr. Shawn Michaels split 100 somas between them in one evening. Over the course of that evening, Mr. Nash took 33 somas, as did Mr. Michaels, and Scott Hall took 34. I ask you, is this the response or the behaviour of a reasonable individual? How unprofessional is it to be taking drugs prior
objection,
to wrestling
objection,
matches?
Your Honor. Objection. Objection. Now, as much as we need to defend our client, Mr. Kevin Nash, we would like it noted that you shouldn't necessarily believe the words that Kevin Nash says. So, we might just like to object against the crap that our client occasionally spews.
Overruled.
Curses!
I ask...
Please continue.
Thank you, Your Honour. One more from the infamous curtain call. Me and Scott did smoke a little something on the way to the building. There'll be more on that later, Your Honour. This malpractice, what I believe was a contributing factor to his poor performances in the ring, undoubtedly had a negative effect on the World Wrestling Federation's business at the time. If I may use some figures from the pay-per-view buy rates of 1995. The WWF Royal Rumble of that year drew one buy rate, the second lowest recorded at that time. WrestleMania 11 drew 1.3 buy rate, the lowest at the time. King of the Ring 95, 0.65, again, the lowest at the time. SummerSlam 1995, a 0.9 buy rate, the lowest of the time. There is a pattern here, Your Honour. And finally, Survivor Series 95, 0.57, the lowest at the time. So it is undoubtable that this unprofessional behaviour, these poor performances in the ring, all through his own selfish actions, had a negative impact on business. The average house show attendance during Kevin Nash's time as champion was 2,691 people, the lowest between the years 1991 to the year 2001. There is also malpractice in regards to what you may say is his legal behaviour, if I may use that term. This is a man who is on record as acknowledging breaking into Ann Russo's office at Titan Towers to steal pay stubs to go over other wrestlers' pay, and then complaining about it. This is clearly the actions of a selfish man with little regard for the company as a whole, who is purely out for what he can get. Now, such selfish behaviour can't possibly be a positive for the company. And finally, when it comes to the events surrounding the curtain call, which I'm sure the defence may claim, Vince was okay with it. Vince was happy for them to do it. That really were the case, Your Honour. Why was Triple H punished? Why did Vince McMahon on several occasions acknowledge his own unhappiness with it? And when it comes to those who claim to verify that Vince McMahon was reportedly okay with this, they are Scott Hall, who Kevin Nash has already acknowledged smoked a little something with him on the way to the building, and Shawn Michaels, who, as I've previously referenced, was also a heavy drug user. And one final remark taken from the 2004 Wrestle Reunion interview with Mr. Scott Hudson on the subject of doing jobs on his way out to help the company, to help its stars. For Take, which for the record is Mark Calloway, I'll do anything. For Sean, I'll do anything. But anybody else, fuck 'em. Now, the defence may laugh and snigger at that, but just think what a victory could have done for someone like Vader, who needed a kickstart during his WWF run. What could it have done for, say, an Ahmed Johnson? Now, I am not here to suggest that that would have solved all the company's problems, but it may have helped. And the point is, Mr. Nash didn't care because he was selfish. That selfishness is the example of his malpractice during this WWF run, and that is why this man is guilty.
Thank you very much, Carl and Mr. Chase, for that first case study regarding Kevin Nash's WWF run. I'll now pass over to the defence and Liam O'Rourke for his, as the title of his role implies, defence of that first case study.
There was a lot of comments made there between both the opening statement and what Carl said that I really want to get to. This whole idea that Kevin Nash as the WWF champion was this colossal failure is something that's very, very important to address. Because let's be quite honest, when it comes to drugs in wrestling, we can't pretend Kevin Nash is the first. Hulk Hogan was a noted cocaine and steroid user for years and years and years, and nobody can combine these ideas of Kevin Nash drug user to Kevin Nash poor worker. There's nothing to connect the two at all, so I don't think it has any kind of notable effect on the business. Ditto breaking into and Russo's office to find out what the company was paying him had absolutely no bearing on the business at the time, and as far as I'm concerned, it's not necessarily negligent as opposed to him actually finding out what he was actually worth in the company at the time.
Your Honour, I'd just like it on record that the defence are condoning breaking and entering.
Noted.
Okay. Chase made a point in the opening statement about the push of Kevin Nash being forced, being too soon. I want to get to this point because I think this is a misnomer that a lot of people have. Hulk Hogan, when he came into the company, was there for a cup of coffee before he was given the world championship. Diesel, when he first came in the company, a lot of people forget, his first match on pay-per-view was at the Survivor Series 93, in which he was in the opener and the first man eliminated. He wasn't rushed to the top straight away. Kevin Nash's initial push came at the Royal Rumble 1994 when he was given 7 eliminations and the crowd responded accordingly. They chanted Diesel, they did get into him, but he was making a big guy look strong, which was what they needed at the time. They needed to boost him up because he was Shawn's heater. Coming out of WrestleMania, it was perfectly acceptable for him to be the Intercontinental Champion. It wasn't too much too soon. He had a very good match with Bret Hart at the King of the Ring. He had a very underrated match with Razor Ramon at SummerSlam in 1994 as well.
Your Honour, I'd like to object there. Those remarks are purely subjective. They're not necessarily rooted in fact.
May I draw your attention to one of your first, in fact, your opening statement, where you drew the assumption, without any evidence, that 1995 is the arse end of wrestling history.
Your Honour, I used by rate.
Therefore, for the purposes of the comments just made, I will overrule you, Carl, and I will apologise to the defence for the rude interruption.
Understood.
Thank you very much, Your Honour. The point is, from Survivor Series to Survivor Series, it was a 1-year slow burn, quicker than most because he was being pushed to the top, but still, it wasn't an overnight deal, and the crowd was with him. The mistake made with Kevin Nash's title run, and believe me, there are many that I'm going to get into, but as soon as they associated him with the WWF title, they started making mistakes with Kevin Nash. He was hot-shied to the belt. Most people forget that by the time he actually won the belt, this was a time in 1994 when news moved a lot slower than it does today. He'd turned babyface at the Survivor Series. 2 days later, he was world champion. By the time he'd beaten Bob Backlund in Madison Square Garden, most people probably didn't even know that he turned babyface at the time. So I think that's, again, the big man fetish of Vince McMahon, it was a rush job. It got him there. There's no anticipation for Diesel as a babyface to be the top guy, to properly put him in that position. Now, Kevin Nash has the belt. We're going to push him to the new top star. His first house show run is with Bob Backlund, a guy who had no business being on top in 1994, and had just been pinned in 8 seconds in footage that they'd showed on television many, many times. Come and see the rematch, folks, this one might go 10. As far as I'm concerned, Bob Backlund was not an adequate challenger on the first run of house shows to make Kevin Nash. Certainly the second person wasn't either. Jeff Jarrett on house shows at the beginning of 1995, not an adequate guy for Diesel to draw money with on top because he wasn't even an established star yet. He wasn't even Intercontinental Champion at this point. He also wrestled IRS in his first couple of months on house shows, as well as a run with King Kong Bundy. But I don't give a fuck what the prosecution wants to say. There is nothing in this company that is more uninspired than the return of King Kong Bundy in 1994. Okay, so moving from this very poor run of first house shows, in which Diesel knows he's not going to draw great numbers because he's in there with crap opponents, they put against Bret Hart in the babyface match at the Royal Rumble. Look at the dynamics involved with these two. Isn't it ironic that just a couple of podcasts ago, we compared Daniel Bryan to Bret Hart and Diesel to Roman Reigns for so many different reasons? And here it was, just like in the current day where they've paired these two together, they did the same thing in January of 1995. And what's happened in real life today is exactly what was likely to happen then. You would not, if you're going to make Roman Reigns the top popular babyface, you wouldn't put him in there with a fan's choice of the past year who was screwed out the belt. It's the exact same premise, it's the exact same scenario. The least likely situation when it came to the audience at the Royal Rumble 95 was for Kevin Nash to come out of that match better than he went going in. Oh, and by the way, Kevin Nash didn't get put over in that, keep that in mind. We move on to WrestleMania. I'm as big a fan of Shawn Michaels as almost anybody in this world, but Shawn Michaels was not ready to headline WrestleMania for the WWF Championship in early 1995. He'd been a mid-carder for most of his career, and he had unfortunately won a Royal Rumble that was littered with mid-card guys and very little top-tier talent. It wasn't enough to elevate him. Not only that, but the feud took a backseat to Bam Bam Bigelow versus Lawrence Taylor, which ate up the lion's share of the promotional time and went on last. Again, thank you very much, Diesel. You can go on semi-main as the new top guy, the face of the new generation. But don't worry, Diesel, because I'm sure we're going to give you something great after WrestleMania. No, he gets Sid. He gets Sid. When has Sid ever drawn any money, ever? I will note right now that the worst buyout for a WrestleMania in history was with Sid as champion, not with Kevin Nash. This also leads, by the way, to the fantastic King of the Ring pay-per-view, which they mentioned, which did do an awful buy rate, because he's in there, in the main event, in a tag match, teaming up with the guy that couldn't beat a football player at WrestleMania in Bam Bam Bigelow, the aforementioned Sid, and heel Tatanka, who had never been in a main event in his life and wasn't built up to be in a main event in his life. Of course, we get a couple of in-your-houses here, but don't worry, the Sid feud, I'm sure will have something great for you for SummerSlam. No, folks. We get Mabel. Mabel, who is awful in absolutely every way. A guy who was a joke wrestler for 2 years. A fat guy wearing a circus tent. Who, 1 year before his main event at SummerSlam, lost clean to Jeff Jarrett, who had barely been in the company for a cup of coffee and wasn't pushed. People forget that Mabel winning the 1995 King of the Ring was a massive shock at the time. We're talking about negligence and malpractice here. Are we going to accuse Kevin Nash of malpractice or negligence because he couldn't have a good match with Mabel? Because in that case, you need to send anybody that ever wrestled Mabel down to, because nobody ever had a good match with Mabel, and by the way, one person ever had a good match with Sid. Anyway, we move on from this horrible abortion of SummerSlam. King Mabel goes back down to the mid-card where he belongs, and he does get a somewhat interesting challenger in Davey Boy Smith. But this didn't work. David Boy Smith was a mid-card guy. He wasn't a made man. He was a guy that was shoved into this role before he was ready. And instead of building the Bulldog up for their pay-per-view match, they built Diesel down with a losing streak gimmick going in, including a loss to Waylon Mercy on Superstars heading into the pay-per-view, including a pinfall job to the British Bulldog on Raw, which sounds like a good idea, but in execution it was a six-man tag. Yokozuna dropped a leg on Diesel and Davey went for the cover. So they hurt Diesel without giving anything to Davey Boy. Davey Boy was a mid-card guy who wasn't ready for a top heel spot. Diesel has been weakened more and more. There are so many weak challenges during this period of time, and yes, the buy rate was not good for a lot of these pay-per-views, especially the Davey Boy one. However, we're talking about 1995 and how bad the business aspect of this was, especially Kevin Nash's title reign. 1 month after he lost the belt at Survivor Series, Bret Hart takes to the main event with Davey Boy Smith and does the worst buy rate in company history, worse than anything Kevin Nash did. And by the way, if you want to talk about Kevin Nash's buy rates, you turn Kevin Nash heel a few months later, he does the best buy rate from In Your House at In Your House 7 in this 2 year period. 1 month later, Sean wrestles Davey Boy, and the buy rate gets cut in half to a 0.4. The common denominator in what doesn't draw here is Davey Boy Smith. We mentioned Davey Boy being a bad draw, Sid and Mabel as opponents for the course of the year. What's he supposed to do? Let's just talk for a second about these buy rates. They kind of mentioned the Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, King of the Ring not doing well. They were the worst years up to this point. What they failed to mention was 1996, the year afterwards, did worse. WrestleMania did worse the next year, and so did King of the Ring. King of the Ring 96 did a 0.6 compared to the 0.65 that King of the Ring 1995 did with an awful main event. In Your House series was brought up in 1995. It was introduced. The concept of the B pay-per-view was something WWF didn't do at the time. B pay-per-views, here's a fact for you. The best two buy rates for In Your House for B pay-per-views in general were number 1 and number 7, both of which were headlined by Kevin Nash. They were the best B pay-per-view buy rates until July of 1998. They beat any B pay-per-view that Bret Hart headlined. They beat any other pay-per-view that Shawn Michaels headlined as champion. They also beat 3 B pay-per-views headlined by Steve Austin after the Mike Tyson angle. So to insinuate that Kevin Nash's numbers are all-time catastrophic is somewhat misleading, considering that most of the ones they mentioned were then worsened, and Kevin Nash holds the high watermark for B pay-per-views and doesn't hold the low watermark. Was Kevin Nash a bad champion in 1995? Is that what people hate about this year, or did the company just suck balls? It was babyface heavy, they had shit heels across the board all year. You got The Undertaker wrestling Karma, you got Bret Hart wrestling The Pirate and The Dentist, you got Razor Ramon wrestling The Teacher. They had no heels all year with any heat, so of course the house shows don't do very well. The fact that Kevin Nash went heel, did a very respectable, very good buy with Shawn Michaels at In Your House 7, then went to WCW and set the world on fire, says that there was money in Kevin Nash, if it was tapped into correctly, if he was used correctly. But the WWF forced him into the same mold as John Cena, Sheamus, Roman Reigns earlier this year, Brock Lesnar in 2003, Smiling Diesel. It's the promo that we all know and we're all familiar with. Artistically, Diesel was not as bad as Yokozuna in the ring, no matter how many drugs the prosecution claims he did that they never saw him do. Financially,
objection, Your Honour, these are drugs which Kevin Nash has openly admitted to doing.
This is the trial of Kevin Nash, and therefore I am prepared to take the evidence provided as a witness statement by Kevin Nash. Therefore, without any contradictory evidence, we must consider what Kevin has said as true.
How about the fact that during this time, WWF had a very stringent drug testing policy and Kevin Nash never failed a drug test at the time? Would that not be contradictory evidence?
I believe the fact that Sid and Davey Boy Smith were still in the company as well, I am suspicious of the validity of the testing in the first place.
There was far more to the story of why 1995 WWF was not very good than just Diesel was champion. And like I said, the evidence is things got worse before they got better.
Okay, well, now pass it back to the prosecution for any comments you may have on this opening case study.
Your Honour, I would like to just follow up on a few of the remarks there made by the defence. At no point during my testimony that did I say that Kevin Nash was the worst drawing world champion of all time. I didn't say they were the lowest watermarks of all time. I'm just pointing out they were the lowest at that time. Now, the defence there made a very, very clever case when almost referring to the power structure within the World Wrestling Federation and the fact that, yes, Vince McMahon was the owner. And did they necessarily treat Kevin Nash as well as they could have from a creative standpoint? Possibly not. But it has been well documented that Kevin Nash was part of a very powerful group within the locker room, and Kevin Nash, had he really objected to such things, could have made his case. He was quite happy on several occasions to go along with these things, including the proposal of possibly losing on a house show to Jean-Pierre Lafitte. the French-Canadian pirate. So does that not suggest malpractice on his behalf? That he was so short-sighted? That he didn't have the conviction to stand up? Is that not negligent on his behalf? I will just point out that if you look at each month in which Kevin Nash was champion, and the breakdown of the individual months of the average of house shows, the corresponding month for the year 1996 did significantly better. June of 1995, the average house show was 3,000. June 96, it was 5,028. In March of 1995, it was 3,190. The corresponding month for the year 1996 was over 3,000 higher than that. It was 6,553.
So we'll pass it back to the defence again for a summary or any retort you may have.
Yeah, not too much to add here. I just want to mention the whole idea of the click being powerful. They wanted to kind of weave this in as malpractice. Although it's kind of a bit of a contradictory thing here, Your Honour, if you actually look at it with any kind of objective vision, which unfortunately the prosecution is failing to do. If he was that powerful and he did lobby for the click to do better, then why wasn't he wrestling them in the main event? He wasn't. If he didn't lobby for the click to get in power, then why would you even call them powerful in the first place? What are you saying, that he needs to lobby for different opponents, for better opponents? How does this tie in together?
Your Honour, I feel that my remarks are being misinterpreted.
Please clarify. Clarify.
What I'm suggesting is, the Click were a powerful group, but my point is, Kevin Nash showed malpractice in the sense that he didn't exercise any power at that time.
That's not his job.
Is it not a failing on his part to raise these concerns?
He may well have. We don't know that he didn't.
Gentlemen, if I can just interject at this moment in time, I would like to bring you back to the definition of malpractice, which is an instance of negligence or incompetence. I would question whether the point of regarding the lack of influence of the click would constitute negligence or incompetence.
But Your Honour, I'm not saying the click as a group weren't influential. I'm saying that they could have chosen to use such power. Kevin Nash clearly didn't have any problems with flaunting rules when it suited him, in terms of breaking into an office, in terms of refusing to do jobs on his way out the door.
Actually, that's one point.
But my point is that for all these negative things that they mention, when there are examples of him sort of booking the trend, if you like, he was happy to go along with wearing the Santa hat and sing with the members of Titan Towers. He was happy to do the smiling baby face Diesel, solely because he was getting paid. And at the end of the day, that's all he cared about.
I'd like to again, this is our counteraction here, anyway, if I recall correctly, Your Honour, this is our time to kind of rebut what they said. I also want to point out, just because he didn't maybe fight for something harder, we don't know that he didn't, necessarily. Would you even call that negligence for trying to do somebody else's job for them? He had a job to do. He had just been put at the top of the company. If he fights things too hard straight away, if he says he doesn't want to do what Vince wants him to do, within the first month, like you said, wearing the Santa hat, singing We Wish You a Merry Christmas to Titan Towers, if he does it then, he's not politically secure enough at the time to be able to get away with something like that. He's not Hulk Hogan. And again, I don't feel that's his job. I don't think it's malpractice or negligence to not fight. Yeah, he may have fought for things harder. We don't know. This disparity between house shows as well, from 1995 to 1996 that Carl brought up, and are perfectly valid numbers. I don't see how this correlates to malpractice with Kevin Nash. They had a better roster in 1996. They had more heels with heat in 1996. The product as a whole was hotter. Kevin Nash is not responsible for the product as a whole. We mentioned before the bad challenges he had. David Boy Smith did not draw with anybody that he wrestled, whether it be Diesel, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart. So trying to label this on Kevin Nash, who would go on to draw money, oh by the way, and does hold high watermarks like we mentioned for pay-per-views, I think it's a little bit of misdirection. I also think the idea of it being malpractice because he didn't want to do any jobs on the way out, that's actually a little bit of a misnomer. He mentioned there that he said he'll do it for Taker, Shawn, and anyone else, fuck him. This was actually in response to the question of will he do jobs for Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker, and The Ultimate Warrior. Not anybody else, not Ahmed Johnson, nobody else. He said he'd do it for Shawn, he said he'd do it for Taker, and he said no to The Ultimate Warrior, which actually proved to be completely fair and accurate considering the fact that Warrior was out of the company 2 months later.
Okay, thanks for that, gentlemen. I think we're going back to the prosecution now for your second case study, and we'll hand over at this point to Mr. G. John Chase.
Thank you, Your Honour. We're now, for our second case study, going to look at his duration in WCW, and in particular, his role as the booker in the company. But just before I get to those exact points and those series of events which will display his poor choices as the head of the booking team, I'm just going to
throw out like just a few little kind of moments from Kevin Nash himself in his early period in WCW, mainly in 97. I'm going to throw out a direct quote here. You would get to work, the beer was on ice already, and we'd start drinking at noon. Okay, so already we're looking at someone who hasn't learnt anything from his time in WWF. It's things like this where, like, his particular behaviour before he even got into the role of Booker. Road Wild 97. On the day of the pay-per-view, Hall and Nash refused to drop the tag team titles to the Steiners as planned, as they believed it would hurt the drawing power of the belts. Another issue, 1st of September 97. Nash and NWO do a horseman skit, mocking the retirement of Arn Anderson, referencing the alleged alcoholism which Anderson's mother nearly died of.
Just a quick correction, that Arn Anderson's mother did actually die of.
The Horsemen were supposed to do a run-in in retaliation, but Nash nixed the idea, thus burying the Horsemen. Arn was so upset, he nearly quit the company. Then, in Starrcade 97, Kevin Nash calls the company, claiming to have had a minor heart attack. The timing is convenient, as it means Nash's scheduled loss to the Giant does not take place, something Nash has been claiming for months he would not do. So those are just like a few examples of what his mentality was like and his professionalism backstage in terms of his role as a wrestler. The period in which we're looking at as Booker, it's been kind of debated at times as to exactly when he became Booker. A lot of people say it was late 98, some have said it was February, early February time of 99. Obviously, in 98, there started to be a slight downward spiral in terms of the product. There were little flash moments here and there of mistakes. Nothing was unfixable at this point. The main appointment for Nash becoming Booker was slightly to do with Hulk Hogan himself. He had a lot of heat at this time, and leading up towards Starrcade 98, the plan was for Goldberg to lose the title back to Hogan, and a lot of people didn't like this. Between them, they decided that Hogan was going to leave for a while, Nash was going to take over as Booker and probably like ease the tides a little bit. Looking at Nash on top in 98, as I already stated, Hogan was originally booked to end the streak. Okay, so I'm not going to claim that the Goldberg streak ending was Nash's fault, because it was quite blatant that Hogan was already planned to do that. But what I am going to comment on in terms of Nash becoming Booker was the way they went about the eventual booking. Nash's first decision to essentially be, I'll choose myself to kill a streak. If we're not going to do it with Hogan, I'll do it myself. And also the way in which the ending of the streak went down. But just before we get to Starrcade, as he takes over as Booker, first off, he decided to put himself over in the three-ring battle royale at World War III to establish himself as the number one contender. He decided to book himself to end Ralph's winning streak in about 4 minutes 45 seconds. So I guess that's how long it takes him to do his five moves. And this is where like the real cleverness of Kevin Nash in terms of how he's going to manipulate the booking situation. He actually decides to put Goldberg over on the lead-up to Starrcade. Because if Nash beats a weakened Goldberg, that doesn't mean anything. Nash was smart enough to realise, I need to make Goldberg look good so that when I beat him, it makes me look even better. So we get to Starrcade 98, Nash wins the title, ends the streak with interference. Hall was going to come out and use a cattle prod on Goldberg. So this is actually how they end the streak. They don't think of a better method of doing this, a legit method, a cattle prod. But the streak ended too soon. And a lot of people consider this to be the beginning of the end of WCW. Nash's defense for this booking of the streak is claiming that Goldberg's sucks chance and booing were already starting to happen. But at this time, folks, this was very minimal at best. This was just a few key locations and a very small percentage. This wasn't like Hulk Hogan in 1995. This wasn't like John Cena in 2006. This was not a good enough reason to immediately end the streak. Although 98's attendance was up from 1997, I just want to state that the bad booking did start to take its toll in 1999. And as a result of this 99 period, WCW had a loss of about $15 million. So we move over to 99. I'm just going to continue with some of the examples of what WCW was producing for their audiences with Nash on top of the booking team. We're going to go to the 4th of January, for a lot of people consider to be the one of the worst nitros ever. After the loss already and the ending of the streak of Goldberg, they decided to run this kind of angle in which Goldberg gets arrested for some sort of altercation with Miss Elizabeth. Whilst Goldberg was dealing with the old fuzz, the main event was changed to Hogan versus Nash.
in which we got the infamous finger poke of doom, because that was a superb idea, wasn't it? It was a great way to change the title. Yes, we also had, you know, Bischoff revealing the Mankind title win as well, also contributed to bad figures, but you have to also think that if the main event on WCW was better than what we got, then surely that would have been a better way of combating any potential viewers leaving to watch the Mankind title win. Badly booked Nitros continued throughout January, things like Flair getting beat up by the NWO in ski masks, who then they beat him up in the middle of a field, I think it was, like, I think they dragged him out of a limousine, beat him up in the middle of a field, and then left him in the field for an hour, which we know that because they kept the camera guy there. We then head over into about the mid-February period, in which we have was considered by some quite an infamous booking meeting that Kevin Nash was hosting, in which Nash says that certain talent need to have the legs taken out from underneath them. Ric Flair, Bret Hart, Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, Chris Jericho, Raven, Canyon, Bam Bam Bigelow, and I believe Roddy Piper as well. This was also the booking meeting in which we had the infamous Vanilla Midgets line. Super Bowl, February 21st. In some absolute genius, they actually decide it's about time Mysterio loses the mask. Okay? They think he's just not marketable enough. Okay? I'm not going to really go too much into the point that years later, when Mysterio actually eventually went into WWE, he actually had the mask.
It's a sore point with men.
Yeah, right, and just, you know, obviously the amount of merchandise they were able to hawk over Rey Mysterio masks to all the kids. But hey, you know, Nash didn't think he was marketable with the mask on. So they decide for him to lose the mask. And the best way they thought about doing this was in a tag team match in which Rey Mysterio and Conan lose to, you guessed it, Kevin Nash. The Super Bowl 99 buy rate, I will state this, that this show did actually get an excellent buy rate. It did. It got a 1.1. Which is absolutely fair enough. It did beat St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which was main evented by Austin McMahon in the cage, but this was the last big draw WCW ever got. February 22nd, Nitro. Nash knew he had heat, so he decided to book himself to lose to Mysterio. Okay, this was as a reward for losing the mask so that he could become, again, marketable. But again, this was very basic. I mean, Mysterio won with a fluke pin. It wasn't put over properly. It was never really kind of mentioned too much afterwards again. And it's, you know, Nash constantly uses this as a frame of reference of, oh, I can work for the boys, you know, I can put the boys over. This is the only mention I can see of anyone in terms of the mid-card or up-and-coming talent that he ever put over. We now get to early March. And Bischoff decides that he's going to go on holiday to France for several weeks. He just disappears and decides to leave Nash completely 100% in charge. This is 100% Nash. He's going to eliminate all of the wrestling out of the first hour of Nitro. We got some kids jumping around at a Nitro party. We got one of the Nitro girls talking about life while sitting on the grass with her dog. A Conan music video. Hogan making fun of Flair, a skit in which Buff Bagwell and Scott Steiner got arrested, and then the police told them in order to get out of these charges, they would have to be cops. There was another skit where Hogan and Nash are watching a promo of Hogan making fun of Flair from earlier in the night. Then there's another skit in which Hogan, Nash and Tori Wilson decide to go to a gun range. And on top of that, because how else to end a lovely evening, but another skit of Hogan, Nash and Tori Wilson going for dinner. And once we get to the 9 o'clock mark, where you're thinking, oh, well, finally, the hour's ended, and we're going to get some wrestling, they decide to go with another skit, in which Flair challenges Goldberg and turns heel. This is the popular Flair that they decide to turn heel. War wins by 2.5 points on that particular show. Talk about uncensored. And the obvious, you know, Hogan-Flair WCW title match, which was a First Blood match. To make this worse, whether it was Hardway or Blading, whatever, Flair bleeds early in the match and leaves the commentators completely confused as they decide to continue with the match. Hogan also starts to bleed. Flair wins with a pinfall in a First Blood match. Also, just a little point on the show in terms of, you know, Nash as head of booker, you know, there should be some sort of management structure there, particularly with Bischoff not being around. Mikey Whipwreck makes his debut on this show and states about the poor management himself, in which he was told different information on the day as to what his match entailed. Jimmy Hart telling him that he was going to win in 10 minutes, or Sullivan telling him he was going to lose in 8. Graham, as if anyone listens to him, said it was going to be a DQ in 5 minutes. Before Arn Anderson told him to ignore everybody else and that he was going to lose in 15. Already, Michael Whipwreck has only been there for a couple of hours, already hates the place. This just shows the poor management structure that Nash has in place. Here's a few more. Bret Hart, who was obviously hot after the whole 97 screw job, WCW in general used him very poorly. Nash himself did not think that Bret was a sufficient draw, and he at any kind of moment tried to nix anything to do with Bret Hart. In particular, the one shining moment in this later period in WCW, which was the Bret Hart Goldberg spear angle with the shield plate on his stomach, Nash tried to nix that in the bud, but luckily I think Bischoff did manage to step in at that point. I think Bret was able to convince him to stick with that angle.
Can I just ask for clarification at this point? Is Eric Bischoff back as booker? What is the role of Kevin Nash at this time?
Bischoff at this time is quite kind of like uncertain. It's like he's coming in back and forth. Nash is still like in the key role of booking these shows and deciding the direction. Maybe certain major decisions he was involved in, but he wasn't involved with, say, the lower card, which is basically where Nash did a lot of his damage.
Because what I'm looking for at this point is the accountabilities.
Another issue, Crazy Flair, where we have this completely convoluted storyline of Flair again locked up in a mental home after stripping down to his underwear and going mental, claiming that he's you know, the world champion and he's the president of WCW and also the president of the United States. Hogan decides to take a sabbatical after Spring Stampede. Nash has complete control. The result was more horrible nitros. Slamboree, in which we did get the return of Bischoff on screen, in which he comes out during the Ric Flair Piper match and basically overrules the decision and says that he's actually the one still in charge, just completely doing away with several months of storylines. And Nash beats Paige for the belt. Surprise, surprise. They had about 13,789 fans. 6 months earlier, they'd managed to fill that place out at 30,000. The buy rate for that show as well was 0.45. This mid-year point, WCW were about 12 million behind in their pay-per-view budget. Also, at Great American Bash, we got a 0.43 buy rate, and at Road Wild, we got a 0.54. We're all headlined by Kevin Nash. About mid-July time, Nash was relegated from head booker, but still had a role on the booking team, so his influence was still around a little bit at this point. On about 14.
Can I just interject at this point?
Yeah.
Given the structure of WCW, mm-hmm. which I think we can all agree on was a clusterfuck,
yeah.
If we are to attribute blame to Kevin Nash when he's the head booker, which I believe is fair,
yeah.
I think that must, in some respect, alleviate him from when he's not in that position, because there are variables which would affect both instances. But I think for the purposes of this trial, we must rest ultimate responsibility when he was the head booker, or other instances of influence.
Okay. On 14th of October 99, which is believed to be the final show as booker for Nash, in which he had any influence at all, Nash was on Thunder commentary and decided to put himself over and burying the show and the talent. Such things as, if I can quote this right, Bill Goldberg, a bull-headed man with a tattoo who only has one last to the great warrior, Kevin Nash. Sid comes on and saying, Sid Vicious, 6'10", 597 pounds. Basically just making an absolute mockery of everything that's on the show. They decide to show a commercial for WCW action figures. I'm sure I had some of those. And as we come back, Nash decides to say, what's with me doing a job in the commercial? And then finally, during a Prince Iaukea Berlin match, because, you know, that isn't bad enough, Tanay states that a tag team matchup has been signed for later tonight, which was going to be the awesome team of the Total Package and Rick Steiner versus the even better team of Buff Bagwell and La Parka. The chairman. He's actually pretty cool, actually. other little comments that he made on commentary. Nash says half the guys didn't show up tonight, so we had to book it earlier today. Nash says that the Saturday show is about to be awoken. Nash says he, Scott Hall, and one of their colleagues are in negotiations for 1 hour of the show with the music, wrestling, guests, and it will be called The Big Shizzo. Tanay asks when we can expect that, and Nash says he doesn't know. He's trying to pitch it right now. Nash says you'll never... Nash also gives us nice little tidbits, such as Nash says you never see Meng and Barry White at the same time.
It's not wrong, yes.
Nash says that the best tag team of all time... And in closing, Nash says the best tag team of all time were the two girls last Thursday.
So this is basically, instead of actually talking about the Prince Iaukea Berlin match, which surely needed all the help it can get, or even trying to promote an inferior tag team main event, Nash decides to be funny instead and just bury everyone that he can. On the Nitros themselves, on the 4th of January 99, the Finger Poke of Doom was a 4.9. Nash's last show as Booker was a 2.6. Before he was Booker, the company did make some mistakes, but it could have still been turned around. But as soon as Nash was in charge, he made big mistakes. But most importantly, the only guy who went over the most during this time period was Nash.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chase, for that. Okay, we'll pass it over to the defence now, and we are going to Liam O'Rourke again for a response to that second case study.
Thank you, Your Honour. There is so much to get to there. There was a very elaborate rundown of various things that happened in WCW. I want to get to the character assassination they tried to put on Kevin Nash there in terms of pre-booking. They mentioned the whole fact that, you know, the beer was on ice. That was the line that was used there. They failed to mention the fact that the beer was actually in Hulk Hogan's trailer, not Kevin Nash's. I think it's a very important distinction to make because it ties into the whole thing of it's the environment that Kevin Nash is in. The fact that, you know, it's deemed a big deal at Hall and Nash that they shouldn't drop the belt to the Steiners. I don't know who this will offend the most. I'm sorry, but there was more money in Hall and Nash than the Steiners in 97. I wouldn't say that was a bad thing to lobby for. A lot of people in the history of the business have lobbied for a cause like that. Kevin Nash at that point had no actual power. He was a wrestler making a suggestion. It was not his decision to make. So I don't really see what the issue is there, to be perfectly honest. The NWO Horseman skit is one of many parody skits that have been done in the history of wrestling. The only reason people took it more personally was because people believed that the NWO had legitimate ill will towards Arn Anderson. The phrase they use, okay, this is a very, very important distinction. Kevin Nash himself, we talked about Kevin Nash's words earlier on, Your Honor, as being part of the idea of, you know, credible witness. He was there. He knows better than anybody. Kevin Nash himself says that he took over the book in WCW in February, mid-February of 1999. The rumors that he took over earlier came from a Pro Wrestling Torch on the 28th of November in 1998, which said that Kevin Nash is an unofficial part of a large committee. That was the extent. He was one voice amongst many at the time. He was not the head booker. The whole idea of what they said repeatedly, Nash decided, Nash decided, Nash decided. Nash did not decide that he was going to win World War III. Nash did not decide that he was going to beat Wrath. Nash did not decide that he was going to go over Goldberg. The decision for Goldberg to lose was already made anyway, and to me, that's far more important than who actually pulls the trigger. Beating Wrath? Who gives a shit about Wrath? Is there any money in Wrath? No. Wrath was not the second coming of Goldberg. Even as a kid, when I watched Wrath beating mid-carders on Nitro and starting to get reaction, I wholeheartedly believed this was a streak that was going to get broken by a guy who's going to challenge Goldberg. It was adequate build-up. If Wrath was money, he would have found a way to the top some other way, and he never did. Again, the use of they used Mikey Whipwreck from Incensored as an example. This is one of the last points I want to make about what they said at the, you know, in terms of character assassination or the company at the time. Mikey Whipwreck being told many different things. They said this is Nash's regime. It's not Nash's regime. Nash isn't in charge of the company. Eric Bischoff is. He's the president. He's the person that puts the power in place. He has the ability, and it was evidenced by the fact that all these things that you mentioned took place before Nash ever got there. Whipwreck doesn't know the finish of a pay-per-view. If Kevin Nash was the head book, if there was one voice, there wouldn't be multiple suggestions. It's different people pulling things different ways. The blame lies squarely on the shoulders of Eric Bischoff. He's the boss. He's the person that has every say, every final say, every final answer. He was the guy that beat Goldberg. Again, he didn't decide to beat Goldberg. If he didn't decide to beat Goldberg, he was just a wrestler that was put in a position. He's no more responsible for the death of Bill Goldberg's streak than Brock Lesnar is in reality for The Undertaker's. He was put in that position by Eric Bischoff. Kevin Nash, and this is very key to note, was not autonomous. He was the head booker from February, but Bischoff did still sign off on many, many decisions. Hulk Hogan had full creative control of everything he did during this period of time. You are not going to hear me say that any of that was good. I'm not going to say that this was great booking. I'm not going to dispute the fact that the numbers went down. The defense is, this is not Kevin Nash's fault. Kevin Nash is not the sole person in charge of the entire company. There's a lot of broad, overarching things that are being blamed on Kevin Nash. Beating Goldberg was a creative decision. The idea was, we're going to fuck Goldberg out the streak. They talk about the nature of the streak ending. If Goldberg gets beaten clean by any of these guys, is that better? No, it's far worse because it actually makes Goldberg look like a twat. Goldberg getting beat by completely nefarious means, and then the whole NWO reuniting the Finger Poke of Doom, which, by the way, Kevin Nash didn't book. It was all to create a mega NWO that Goldberg would smash through one at a time and do what they should have done in the first place, And guess what happened? From the booking, Goldberg beats Scott Hall, who gave him the cattle prod. He beats Bam Bam Bigelow at the February pay-per-view. He even beats Kevin Nash clean. The reason this angle gets completely fucked is because Hulk Hogan pisses off at Spring Stampede because he doesn't want to do a job. And I need to scale it back even further because Hulk Hogan, in March, as they mentioned, turns babyface. There's an important distinction here because at Starrcade 98, the buy rate is a 1.1 for Goldberg versus Nash. Super Brawl, they mentioned, again, 1.1. This is in February. This is the show that beat St. Valentine's Day Massacre, Austin versus Vince in a cage, which shows that the company wasn't doomed by the finger poker doom. The money-spending audience was still there. What fucked the money-spending audience and what fucked the live crowd was turning Flair heel and Hogan babyface because the decline is noticeable from that point. In Ric Flair's book, he states, the idea to turn Flair heel and Hogan babyface was Ric Flair's idea that he convinced Hulk Hogan to do. Hulk Hogan had full creative control on his contract, and Kevin Nash couldn't overrule him. So even if Kevin Nash didn't want to do it, and he didn't, because in Bret Hart's book, he mentions a meeting that he had with Kevin Nash, Hulk Hogan, and Eric Bischoff, where he asked what was going to happen in 1999 with him. Hogan and Bischoff said Hart was going to work with Hogan in the summer. Kevin Nash disagreed and said that Hogan was supposed to wrestle Goldberg in the summer as the end of this angle. But the point was, Nash was outvoted in that meeting. Natio, the whole comeback push from Goldberg after he loses the streak, Nash did put Goldberg over, Hulk Hogan didn't, and that killed the angle. Hogan returns as red and yellow Hulk Hogan, by the way, which nobody wanted to see, and again, the decline in the ratings and the house shows continue. They mentioned the Bret Hart steel plate angle and said that Kevin Nash was trying to nix this. Bret Hart, in an RF video shoot interview, says that the angle was actually Kevin Nash's idea. Kevin Nash was the one that came up with the idea for Bret Hart to wear the steel plate under his hockey jersey. In the same RF shoot interview, Bret Hart details the creative process. Again, this is during Kevin Nash's official reign as the booker. Bret Hart gets the idea from Kevin Nash, the head booker. He goes up to Bischoff to discuss it and clear the angle, showing that even though Nash is head booker, he has to clear it with Bischoff still. Bischoff tells him to clear it with Goldberg. Goldberg has no fucking creative say at all, but he has to clear it with Goldberg. He clears it with Goldberg. He comes back. Bischoff says, great. They go to Toronto to do the show and shoot the angle. Bischoff shows up on the night and says, what if we do the angle exactly as you said, but Hulk Hogan comes down the aisle after you've laid out Goldberg, goes to high-five you, and then kicks you in the balls and beats you down. Bret Hart looks at him like he's got three heads. He says, why the hell would we do that? Bischoff is biting his nails and he's nervous because Bret Hart shot down a Hogan idea. Bischoff then says, if you clear your angle with Hogan, then we'll do it. Why? No idea, because he's not the head booker, but Bret Hart has to swan along to Hulk Hogan and clear the angle with him. It does get cleared, Hogan says, why would I be out there, and they do the angle. But you might notice that head booker Kevin Nash is not in any of these discussions on whether this angle's actually going to make the air, despite the fact that he came up with it in the first place. And this is out of the mouth of Bret Hart in an RF video sheet interview. No jokes, Carl, please. If Nash was that bad during this period of as a booker, Bischoff should have stepped in. That's his responsibility. Instead, like you mentioned, he went on holiday. That's negligence and malpractice on Bischoff's part. Kevin Nash, the ratings were hamstrung. The buy rates were hamstrung from the decision by Hogan to turn babyface, which is above Nash's head. Kevin Nash didn't bring in Kiss, Megadeth, Chad Brock, Master P, Dennis Rodman, and DJ Ran in 1999, overspending to put them in that deficit that they said at $15 million losses a year. Eric Bischoff signed off on absolutely all of them. The company was a disorganized mess that was ruined by awful management. Nash is one contributory factor. There was a meeting that was mentioned there as well, Your Honor, that Kevin Nash had, talking about how we want to hold down Bret, Benoit, Malenko, Guerrero, Raven, Jericho, all these vanilla midgets. What did Bret Hart, Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Raven, or Chris Jericho do in 1998 at the top when Kevin Nash wasn't the booker? Nothing. The point here is, and that doesn't necessarily exonerate Nash by any stretch of the imagination, but the point that I want to make is, there's a pattern here. It's Bischoff's vision for what WCW is supposed to be. The same guys in the same places, not on the top, because Hulk Hogan has to be. The key decision, like we said, that killed buy rates and ratings, was above Nash's head that Nash couldn't do anything about. Was the TV bad? Yeah. But again, Nash had a job, but he had so many people over his head and pulling things in different directions that there was only so much he could do. The idea of malpractice on Kevin Nash's behalf cannot truly be given. He cannot be charged with malpractice when it is so murky, the waters are so muddy on just how much Kevin Nash had to do with the product that we saw. Just to use another case study from Bret Hart in that RF video shoot interview, Bret Hart goes away for months after his brother dies, comes back, and is used, originally, to be backstage as part of a pull-apart brawl in his first television appearance back. Bret Hart asks why this is going to happen. Who's he talking to? Not Kevin Nash. Eric Bischoff. 5 minutes before Nitro's set to start, Bret Hart and Eric Bischoff are walking to the curtain with Bischoff telling Bret Hart what he's supposed to say in the promo that's going to happen in 5 minutes' time. Where's Kevin Nash? Who knows? But he's not the one that's calling the shots here. Eric Bischoff is. Bam Bam Bigelow, G mentioned there, is a guy who, you know, Kevin Nash tried to put down in that meeting and say we need to emphasize him less. Quote, Kevin Nash did try. He tried to do the right thing. The only problem was that the boys didn't want to back Kevin. Kevin might have been successful, but most of the talent didn't respect him as the booker. That's coming from one of his enemies. That's over to you.
Okay, thank you for that. Would the prosecution like to comment on anything said
yes,
there?
Yes, Your Honour. There are a few interesting phrases thrown out there, such as autonomy, sole responsibility. My esteemed colleague here may have been somewhat overzealous at times with certain phrases. I am not suggesting in any way that Kevin Nash is solely responsible for these actions. And in no way am I exonerating Eric Bischoff of his responsibilities. But Kevin Nash was bestowed an element of power, which I believe he chose to use irresponsibly. Now, you mentioned the Steiners and the notion of Hall and Nash being more of a draw. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you there, but the issue is it's the behaviour. Going up to Bischoff on the day of the show, saying they don't want to drop the straps because the changing of belts will hurt its drawing power. Is Bischoff responsible for being negligent? Absolutely. But by the same token, I'm not saying that Bischoff should be exonerated. Nash still has some element of responsibility to use his power wisely, and he doesn't. You even referenced yourself there, contributing factor, not all on Nash. Well, that suggests from the defence's own perspective, there is an element of blame there with Kevin Nash. Now, nor will I suggest that Wrath was going to be the next breakout main event star who would ride the company onto pastures new. But to cut him off the knees means he may have amounted to a bit more than Brian Adams' steam room buddy. You mentioned the meeting and try to wash over any negative element that Kevin Nash may have played. Now, I'm not disputing that those individuals, such as Benoit, Malenko, Jericho, were misused prior to this meeting. They absolutely were. But by Kevin Nash suggesting that these people need to be cut off at the knees, or referring to them as vanilla midgets, only serves to reinforce that negative aspect, to bury morale even further. I'm not saying the situation could have been saved, but Kevin Nash certainly didn't make it any better, and didn't attempt to make it any better. On the subject of Rey Mysterio, and the quote-unquote putting over, was the suggestion to lose the mask Eric Bischoff's? Absolutely. But when you get to the match where he loses the mask, what is Kevin Nash's reaction to Rey Mysterio's unmasking? He treats it as a joke. He laughs. He pulls faces as if he's hideous, completely underplaying the significance of Mysterio losing the mask. The notion that Kevin Nash gives him his win back. What does this match involve? A mock test of strength to emphasize Rey Mysterio's lack of height. And a fluke pinfall in which Kevin Nash stumbles backwards for a quick pin. And we'll then quickly fast forward to the uncensored pay-per-view where Kevin Nash then promptly beats him, taking back Mysterio's win. Not really the way you're going to push a talent. Maybe nice to point out and say, look, I'm the company man. But who walks out the better at the end, and who's made to look a joke throughout? And don't the defence dare try and suggest that they then pushed Rey Mysterio as some sort of giant killer, because beating Scott Norton isn't worth a bucket of warm piss. Now, on the subject of Kevin Nash being the booker at the end of 98, not being the booker at the end of 98, there is some uncertainty there. And yes, Eric Bischoff did make the decision for Goldberg to lose the streak. But he didn't pick Nash. Nash volunteered himself because Kevin Nash only cares about Kevin Nash. But I may use Kevin Nash's own words regarding the subject of the streak and the finger poke of doom. I was given a degree of power. I said, shit, I'll beat him, and I laid out the angle. I've always had stroke. We do the thing with Hogan, with the Miss Elizabeth sex thing, we dogpile him in the Georgia Dome. We were just trying to get the NWO back together, and I just said, we'll just do this. It was my idea. I'll take it. On the subject of his last day, in terms of title at least, of head booker, on the Thunder Show that my colleague referenced. No one's going to suggest that Prince I.K. of Berlin's going to change the business, but the manner in which he talks about these things will either at best confuses the wider audience because he doesn't know what they're talking about when it comes to having to book on the day of the show and I'm pitching my ideas now. At best it confuses the audience, at worst it buries the talent in the ring, which whilst terrible they may be, you're only doing yourself a disservice by making the situation worse. And on the subject of Goldberg and Sid, it's worth remembering that was a featured matchup going into Halloween Havoc. It was a prominent part of the show, and Kevin Nash just decides to make a joke of the pair of them. Is Eric Bischoff ultimately responsible? No doubt. It does happen on his watch. But what we, as the prosecution, are saying is that Kevin Nash did contribute. Our charges are not to say that Kevin Nash is solely responsible for these incidents, but we are saying he showed malpractice. And I think that's worth remembering. The defence are trying to conflate the issue.
Thank you very much for that. That's very insightful and informative. And we'll pass over now back to the defence, Mr. Edwards, for a rebuttal to the prosecution's statements there.
Thank you. This conversation has gone round and round and round. And it is pleasant to almost have the final word, because I think both sides have made good points. It's just that one side has made much better ones. Fortunately, I'm sitting on that side. There aren't even that many more points I need to make, because I believe that the prosecution has not rebutted most of the points we made. I just want to point out the thing that sticks in my mind, because I've had a lot of time to sit and listen. Part of my job here is to listen and absorb, much like you listeners at home, and hopefully you'll come to the same decisions as I have in regards to your opinion. You see, the words that you and I have heard again and again and again is them, it's they. And those words don't come from the defence. They come from the prosecution. But at the end of the day, them and they are words that clearly we should be using. Because responsibility is spread out among a lot of people. You've heard a lot of names go back and forth. You've heard Bischoff. You've heard this, that, and the other. And Nash was indeed part of a booking committee for some time. But that is a they. That is a big they. And going by the precedent of the Triple H case that we have already had on this show, which came to much the same point, the thems and the theys, it cannot be pinned on one man. And the point the prosecution made repeatedly is, hey, if he'd have wanted this, he'd have campaigned for it, and he'd have done this, and he'd have done that. We don't know how much he campaigned. We don't know. Even if he had campaigned to the maximum that he possibly could, we don't know. Either in WCW or in WWF, whenever he campaigned. We don't know what he could have done to make it happen. We don't know how much he did campaign. We don't know anything like that for sure. But I will say, while he was not in charge of the company, head booker is a serious position to be taken seriously. But I think it needs to be noted that while we do talk, all the talk here, around this table, over and over, I'm hearing all the WCW main event stuff, but I'm also hearing little things like how hard done by people like Benoit and Malenko were, which got me thinking. Because in that time where Kevin Nash was head booker in 1999, it clicked in my head that was actually a really good time for Benoit and Malenko. They had a fantastic, there was a good tag team thing going on there with Benoit, Malenko, Kidman and Mysterio. I personally remember it very fondly. Exactly. And that was actually a lot of interesting stuff happening there. The cruiserweight division was not in a really bad state there. In fact, it was 2 months after Kevin Nash stopped booking, you had the Oklahoma Medusa shit. That was after. During that time, you had Blitzkrieg and Hoovy doing all this stuff. Kevin Nash was head booker during this period. I'm not saying this is going to turn business around. I'm not saying it's going to change the business. But I'm saying that it's not all shit. And we colour it as one thing in our minds, historically. But, you know, I got some fond memories of certain things happening in that era when Kevin Nash is head booker. And I don't think it's fair that we colour everything black and white. Even in a position where I think we can all agree that WCW was certainly not top of its game. In the same way that we can all sit around and talk about how 95 was all so terrible, it's not all black and white. And I think it is only fair for this judge to understand that there are shades of grey in all these instances. Even in the darkest times of WCW, blah, 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 there was things happening that I remember, which says something, because I don't remember jack shit about Raw last week. And to me, I think that's important. Because the prosecution would have you think that it was a dire and dark and horrible time. Well, if that is the time, if that is the time where Kevin Nash was most culpable, and even then, certainly not 100% culpable, that's when he was most culpable? Eh. I'll take it over what I've got today and tomorrow coming up on Raw and SmackDown. I'm just taking the argument in a completely different direction.
Objection, Your Honour. We're not here to debate the merits of Raw and SmackDown in the present day.
I'm just lending context for those listeners who were not around at the time.
Thank you for that. I agree, much in a similar vein to the Eric Bischoff comments, but given it is to illustrate the case of Kevin Nash, I am prepared to let it stand. Okay, thank you very much for that, gentlemen. I think it's now time we're going to move on to the final closing statements. Sum this up for me and convince me. Come on. Carl Jones, on the prosecution, you're up first.
I can convince you in private if you want.
Objection. Oh. I'm sick.
Yeah. Offer rejected or whatever.
Rescinded. Oh, no, rescinded. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of things, we'll make the chopping room floor. Your Honour, what we have seen today is a quite deliberate, and I will say quite clever attempt by a defence to conflate a situation, to try and muddy the waters. The defence have tried to insinuate that we are blaming all of the WWF and all of WCW's ills on Kevin Nash. That is simply not the case. We are merely suggesting that Kevin Nash was negligent, that he has some element of responsibility involved here, and that is why he should be found guilty. The defence themselves have acknowledged this, again with phrases such as contributing factor and most culpable. So the defence themselves have acknowledged negative elements and malpractice from Kevin Nash. The numbers speak for themselves. Terrible buy rates in both companies. Terrible house show numbers in the WWF. House show numbers in WCW that had halved. Terrible television in which Kevin Nash chose to associate himself, regardless of whether or not he was solely responsible. He associated himself with these negative elements, and that in itself is malpractice. The defence tried to insinuate towards the end of this trial that many of those individuals in the mid-card were used well, but they didn't give any context. They mentioned the name Blitzkrieg, they mentioned one or two other names, but they can't put them in context because there is no good context to speak of. They were used in the mid-card, and that is why they chose to leave. Kevin Nash was not solely responsible for the mistreatment of many of these individuals through his mismanagement as head booker, perpetuated the negativity already surrounding the situation. He made it worse. He was, as the defence say, a contributing factor. They suggest that we can't look at these things in black and white, and that we're only looking at the main events. Well, what is a company's strength, if not its main event? Your Honour, Kevin Nash is a selfish individual who has never cared for the greater health of the business. He has cared solely for himself and some of his select friends. I implore you to find this man guilty of malpractice. And we have used Kevin Nash's own words several times throughout the course of this case. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to use them one more time. The reason I thought we all got into wrestling was to hang out with your buddies, watch yourself wrestle, then put yourself over.
We need to gag that man.
Thank you, Carl. Powerful, powerful last words there. The defence for their closing statement.
Thank you, Your Honour. This has indeed been an odyssey. The fact of the matter is, in the WWF, he was in an unwinnable scenario as the world champion. He was on top of a company that was awful in every single way, with far more far-reaching implications than just what Kevin Nash did in main events. I didn't hear, through the course of the prosecution, any real substance to the idea that Kevin Nash's negligence or malpractice had in any way any kind of additional negative influence on the business of the WWF at the time. In WCW, as the head booker, he was given a phony crown. Others around him had all the power. Carl uses isolated words there, such as contributing factor, as part of it. The point is this, was he a part of it? Yes, he was. How much of what he did was negative is almost impossible to determine, considering the situation he was in. Much like the WWF in 1995, there is no way to know what Kevin Nash, what more could he have done with what he was given. I didn't hear anything in that nature from the prosecution. What more could he have possibly done other than maybe fight harder for a different product, in which case he still didn't have the power to change anything anyway. Similarly, in WCW, the product, yes, it was horrible, but Kevin Nash, and we gave examples where Kevin Nash, during his period as head booker, came up with ideas that then had to go through the ringer, from Hogan to Bischoff, to other members of talent who didn't have creative control, before Bischoff gave his stamp of approval on the final thing. We don't know what was good and bad from Kevin Nash. We cannot tell what Kevin Nash came up with compared to what we saw, because there are so many layers and so many channels that it has to get through, and did have to go through in many cases, before we got the end result. To find Kevin Nash guilty of malpractice based solely on a brief stint as head booker, based on a championship reign that was mired by a company that was completely out of touch, had a dated vision, had no depth whatsoever, which you yourself, Carl, have mentioned before, the Royal Rumble 1995, in terms of absolutely no depth on this roster, that's what Kevin Nash had to work with, what he had to draw with. We mentioned the guys he had to work with on house shows: Backlund, Jarrett, IRS, Bundy, Sid, Mabel on pay-per-view, Davey Boy, who was pay-per-view death. This is what Nash has to work with. What's Nash gonna do? In WCW, he had power, and the actual detriment of the company started with a decision that Kevin Nash had no power to change, which was Hogan's decision to turn babyface and Flair's to turn heel. At best, you can pick out isolated incidents. We're not here to charge him on isolated incidents. We're here to charge him on a pattern of negligence and malpractice from a professional. That is not the case. That has not been demonstrated here today. And I implore you, Your Honor, to see this for what it is. A witch hunt.
Gentlemen, thank you both sides, all four of you, for your contributions to this trial. I'm going to go for a quick cheeky smoke, think about what's going on here, and I'm going to come back with a judgment. There's a lot of tension in this room right now.
I've shit myself.
I want to shit myself. They really have shit themselves. I think that should be taken into account.
Back in five.
Blame it on Nash.
Well, not for you. Back in like 2 seconds. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and your efforts this evening. Okay, given this a lot of thought, obviously throughout the evening and in the last 5 minutes, having my cheeky fag, the prosecution throughout has clearly demonstrated that Kevin Nash has been in close proximity to some of the lowest downturns in the business of both WWF and WCW. They have, in my mind, clearly demonstrated that Kevin Nash is a selfish individual, a charlatan, a chancer, a bullshit artist, backstabber, two-faced, probably not very trustworthy. The defence have attempted to disperse the blame for those incidents of failure in the WWF and WCW through environmental issues, the poor positioning of challengers during Nash's run, the management environment during WCW. For the purposes of this court case, however, the charge is malpractice, which we clearly defined at the start of this trial as instances of negligence or incompetence. While reviewing this court case, I have had a frame of reference which I've been trying to refer to internally as what would have happened to those respective companies if Kevin Nash was never born? And for the purposes of this trial, I believe the WWF would still have had no challenges for whoever was the champion in 95, and I cannot in good conscience attribute incompetence or negligence on the behalf of Kevin Nash during that 95 run. In terms of his booking, again, I similarly feel that the defence have done a superior job explaining the context behind some of the decisions that were made during Kevin Nash's run. Although Eric Bischoff is not on trial here, the referencing of Bischoff's overarching position within the company mustn't be underestimated in terms of a management structure and the environment that breeds. It is my opinion In agreements with the closing statement, however, as stated, Kevin Nash is undoubtedly a selfish individual. He looks out for the best interests of himself, and he has exhibited numerous examples of less than perfect employee behaviour throughout his tenures in various companies. However, drug abuse is not a standalone feature of Kevin Nash's career only. Selfishness is not solely attributed to Kevin Nash as a wrestler or a booker. The charge is malpractice, gross malpractice no less, and for the purposes of this trial I feel that Kevin Nash is not guilty.
Yeah!
Kevin Nash, once again, wins.
Handshake here, Luke. Good job.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Very happy with that outcome there, Your Honour. Or Kieran, as I can now call you. Before we wrap this up, I want to get a little bit of inside the courtroom studio, I guess, kind of a thing. I want to actually kind of get a read of what everyone's honest opinions are, because we always open the show with the opinions that don't necessarily reflect our true ones. I've got to say, I'm very happy we got the win there, Luke. But in my own personal opinion, while I don't legitimately believe that he's to blame for his WF run being utter shit, God, man, TV under Nash was fucking terrible on Nitro. It was awful. Luke, I want to get you in here, because this was most challenging for you, I think, because of your real-life opinions of Kevin Nash.
Yeah. So you folks at home probably noticed I didn't talk much during that, and it's not because Liam is a vindictive bastard and just cut me out. No, to be fair, a lot of that was due to a lot of good points being made. I think I disagree with Kieran on the final decision in the end.
What?
Yeah, I do. I can say it now. I think actually Kieran made a really good argument in explaining his final decision that we didn't make in the defense, which was defining what the negligence and such was within the context of wrestling. Because I think that if you take it outside the context of wrestling, is he a negligent human being? As a human being, yes. Is he negligent in the context of professional wrestling as compared to all the surrounding stuff? Probably not. I mean, he's, you know... So, that's a point that we didn't really make that I think only really occurred to me when Kieran was talking about it. I have a habit of not liking wrestlers, and indeed actors, or anyone else, really, who I just consider not a pleasant person. I have problems differentiating... people I consider just to be a dick, no matter how good a performer they may be. And obviously with Kevin Nash, I don't suffer from the how good a performer they may be side of things. I do not care for Kevin Nash. But when the point was made, when the... It was an interesting point to defend, but Liam kind of had this one, suffice to say. I'd say I may side with the other side in the end.
Carl, I know what you think of Nash. This is your first defeat in SCG Court. I know you're proud of the streak, but much like Goldberg's, it had to come to an end.
Four and a half.
Yeah.
That's another streak Nash has demolished.
Come on, Carl, let's hear it. I know that you're crying into your Carlsberg.
There have been many miscarriages of justice over the years. The Kirov murders. The O.J. Simpson trial. But in all honesty, this couldn't be more of a kangaroo court if Skippy himself were the judge.
Oh, that's bullshit.
No, I've never been a big fan of Big Sexy. In all honesty, I think I made a bit of a dog's dinner of the first section of the trial. I was sort of caught between two sort of frames of mind, and I got too far down the sort of the drug use, if you like. It was this attempt to create a sort of character assassination, basically. I won't lie, it was a character assassination. But I struggled to frame it in the wider context. That being said, this is a man who's an absolute prick. And a lot of the things that he did in WCW... Yeah, he's... They've already got the gunshot wound that they're trying to sort out with a plaster... But I just feel like his solution to it was to sort of walk up and just poke the wound. but no, credit to the defence. They did a good job, and I'm going to drink more Carlsberg.
All right, over to you, G, because I want to know, in the trial of Eric Bischoff, you did a lot of reading, a lot of research, and your opinion on how important Eric Bischoff was to the death of WCW accelerated massively the more you researched the case. So I want to know if that's the case with Kevin Nash, or did everything that you read kind of change your opinion at all as you prepared for this?
I'd like to think at some point someone's going to be held responsible for WCW.
Bischoff.
Well, no!
We dropped the ball, like it's basically the case on the last trial. We should have beaten Bischoff.
Hold on, that's a point.
Sorry,
if I can just jump in a second.
Just bear that in mind, folks. I was on the team that got Bischoff off the hook, but I couldn't get Nash sent down.
Maybe you should have said that actually during the case itself.
Yeah.
If Bischoff was innocent previously, you should have referenced that.
That's the thing.
Someone has to be.
That's the thing. I was thinking that the entire time, even before we were doing this, as I was writing everything down. Both of them are guilty. They blatantly are. It's him, it's Nash, it's Hogan, Vince Russo for pissing on the ashes. So I wouldn't be surprised if all but one of those probably get off. Nash, personally, I find him quite humorous. I think he's quite funny in his dry wit.
You can't tell me when you're reading those Thunder quotes off that you didn't smile a little on the inside.
I smile a little bit because it's just like, I know, like, he's an asshole. He's an asshole, and I kind of like people who are funny assholes because they just amuse me. But yeah, so it's kind of interesting reading like things back and actually kind of reading the same book, but now looking at it through different eyes. Because before I was looking at all the stuff that says Bischoff in it, and now I'm looking for all the bits that say Kevin Nash, and it's a mixture of both. It's why both should have been sent down. It's like, you know, Kevin Nash. He came up with the ideas, and then Eric Bischoff ticked it. So they're both as freaking guilty as each other for the shit that happened. So yeah, I don't know. It's a tricky one. Well played by the defense, and I apologise for Carl. I'm sorry you don't get that set of steak knives with your winning streak as being the only guy who hasn't won a court case yet. I think I'm probably better off as a judge. At least I fucking convict, even if it was only for half of one.
I think a lot of what it comes down to with this kind of format of show is it's absolutely all in the wording of the charge, as we found out over the course of time, because the Bischoff one we made, I think we went a step too far, perhaps, in the sense that we worded it that he was the most responsible. But like we discussed in this Kevin Nash case, even like you said there, that, you know, Nash came up with a shit idea, Bischoff ticked it, there are so many other forces in play. Even just given the examples that from one interview with Bret Hart that I found, so if I can find that many with one guy, you can just imagine, it had to have been rife in WCW, which makes it hard to sum up any individual element, because the fact is, it's just one big lump of turd.
It was, and I mean, as I did state at the time, like, 98 did have some bad stuff in it before Nash came along, but it was recoverable. And that's the thing, like, when Nash took over, Nash wasn't solely to blame on this. Eric Bischoff did have to, dot the I's and cross the T's and everything. But it's not a coincidence that everything that I'd stated, like all these things that happened on Nitro and the shows, happened whilst Nash was head of the booking team. It's not a coincidence. And it's just infuriating. It's infuriating that he got off.
Yeah, I mean, my honest opinions on Kevin Nash, I mean, there's no getting away the shit he's been in close proximity to. But I know my personal feeling towards the guy is, again, yeah, he's a chancer. He's a guy. He'll just milk and manipulate any opportunity that's there. For the purposes of this case and the wording of it and the direction it went, I was looking for a real tangible impact that wouldn't have happened without him. Negligence to really, you know, to change the course of either company. I just think, as I said, both times, is he a contributing factor? Yeah, of course he is, because how can you not be? So that, yeah, as you said, they all those guys involved in the situations. But I just, the closest to negligence I think the prosecution came up with was when he's on commentary on Thunder and he's burying his own product. That's, for me, was as close to negligent as he demonstrated. The rest, I thought, it's pro wrestling bullshit amped up.
The company was on a downturn anyway, so even if someone else was in charge, you know, to say that they wouldn't have made mistakes as well, because it just, at that time, the company just seemed to be making them almost quite constantly, whether Nash was around or not. But at the same time, there were people in that company that maybe given an opportunity could have turned things around, and Nash like held those people down. And the thing I think that makes Nash the complete asshole if not strangely lovable, is that when you ask about any of those things and you read off those list of things of situations that happened from late 98 through to 99, and Nash doesn't give a fucking shit. Anyone else where major bad things happen, you might hear like Triple H or Shawn Michaels or Bret Hart turn around and say, well, I wish things didn't happen that way. They did, we can't change it, but I wish things happened that way.
Or the opposite is a guy like Bischoff who just takes no responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's just Nash who just doesn't give a flying fuck. He doesn't give a fuck if, you know, they buried Anderson in that Horseman promo. Doesn't give a shit if Flair was walking around in his underwear. Doesn't give a shit that Bret Hart was underutilized. Doesn't care, because he only cares what, you know, that, which is me gesturing a money sign.
With Nash, it's so hard because he's full of shit, and he's like the dude. He seems like a guy who, he's a constant worker. Whether it's, you know, the boys when he's booking, or so-called enemies like Bam Bam, and he's a manipulator. And I think throughout his whatever he's done, I think he's always had an excuse. And I think that's the thing of this trial. There's always an excuse, and he's been a master over the last 15 years, whatever. So 18 years. 20 years over the last 20 years of using excuses and to explain the situation and take the heat off himself. I think he's a charlatan.
The one thing I just wanted to mention there, that it was amazing because me and Luke were kind of looking at each other and gesturing for this idea, but we didn't actually get it in, was the weakness of our defence. I think was we actually completely failed to illustrate just how important Kevin Nash was to WCW becoming what it was in the first place, which allowed him the position he had. It wasn't like he was a career of absolute utter failure by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's probably the weakness of our defence, to be quite honest and honest with ourselves.
The reason why we didn't talk about 96.
Yeah.
Apart from that, the only time I won't want to be a judge is when we eventually do the trial of John Cena, in which case I'd like to be the defence.
Oh, all of a sudden he's changed his stance after years!
How is this concept going to start?
This idea began with G. John Chase's prosecution and Kieran O'Rourke's defence for John Cena, and how the world has turned in the last few years. That's amazing.
That's how good I am on defence, baby.
Just leave him alone! I want to thank everybody for listening this far. This has been a hell of a show, and we'll be back again next week. So for G. John Chase...
Triple H is so lonely in his cell.
And so is Ahmed.
Oh, he's got things to do.
For Kieran O'Rourke.
Laters.
For Carl Jones.
More testicles mean more iron.
For Luke Edwards.
I just want to hit my gavel.
And one day you will. I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.